From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Adam Smith explains why debt is the four-letter word of the 1980s. Smith is a best-selling financial writer, host of his own public television series, and the author of a new book about the financial excesses of the decade. Christopher Hitchens is a British journalist based in Washington. He makes no bones about his own left-of-center politics. Coming up, Hitchens critiques the American press for hiding a clear conservative bias behind what he calls the ideology of objectivity. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers the late Ricky Nelson, and book critic John Leonard reviews African Madness, a new collection of travel essays by Alex Shumatov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Adam Smith says that the 80s have been a financially topsy-turvy decade. For a while, the Navy was selling off ships to investors, then leasing them back because the tax code made it cheaper to lease than to buy. In the 80s, there was more glamour in trading than in making. Corporate raiders became celebrities. The financial excesses of the decade are chronicled in Adam Smith's new book, The Roaring 80s. Adam Smith is actually the pen name of George J.W. Goodman. Under his pseudonym, he's become the best-selling author of Super Money, Paper Money, and The Money Game, and the host of the public television program Adam Smith's Money World. Goodman is a co-founder of New York Magazine and a former executive editor of Esquire. As Adam Smith, he wrote columns for both magazines. He's also served on the board of directors of several large corporations, including U.S. Air and Hyatt Hotels. I asked him if the title of his new book, The Roaring 80s, was meant to draw a parallel between the financial climate of the 80s and the 20s.
Absolutely. The Roaring 20s were a time of increased bank debt and popular presidents and easy spending, and so have the Roaring 80s been. In fact, I think there is a lot of cyclicality in American life and American history.
Does that mean you're looking at a big depression around the corner?
No, I don't think so, because everything doesn't have to come out the same way. But a lot of the same elements are in place. I didn't mean to emphasize the possibility of a depression, but in the 20s, it was not only fashionable to make money, but fashionable to spend it. You could be photographed with your new house, your new apartment. What's happening now is that magazines like Architectural Digest and House and Garden are replacing Playboy and Penthouse. It's kind of a plutography.
Pinning up nice spreads of living rooms.
Money is very fashionable, and the spending of money is very fashionable. And this is one of the cycles in American life.
You say that the four-letter word of the 80s is debt. Now, the national debt grew by more than $1 trillion during the Reagan administration. Would you explain what that means practically for we citizens of America?
It means the same thing it would mean if you borrowed it personally. You have to pay the interest on it. And the detriment is that you have the interest charges that we pay are higher than they were before. They're about 14 cents on the dollar. They're the third highest item in the federal budget, and they're not an item that you can do anything about. You could decide to cut the post office. You could cut the Navy. You could cut aid to higher education. You can't cut the interest. That's a contract with a bondholder. So it does set up something inexorable. The alarming thing to me is that we don't save enough as a country to provide this pool for the government to borrow from. So it has been borrowing it marginally from foreigners, which is why so much attention to the trade deficit. In fact, it's specifically been borrowing it from Japanese life insurance companies.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Why Japanese life insurance companies?
Well, because we borrow a lot from the Japanese as a whole, and the medium by which the Japanese lend to us, in other words, the Japanese public saves 22% of its income. We save about 4%. And the way that they do is they buy life insurance policies or life insurance investments. They have the money to invest. They buy U.S. Treasury bonds. And so we have this curious phenomenon of the United States government nervously watching the portfolio managers at Japanese life insurance companies.
Now, you said that we have to borrow money from Japan because we don't have enough savings in America. And you indicate in your book that you think the attitude towards savings has changed, that people don't save like they used to.
Well, they don't. They would have not been very bright to have done so. We've gone through a period of inflation, and it rewarded people to borrow. First of all, the interest was deductible. That's what a society said. And second, you were a fool to save because tangibles, houses, land, baseball cards, art objects went up faster than the rate at which you borrowed. That's turned around now, or in many areas it has. But there was a previous era in which we did save for the same reason the Japanese save, a fear of the future. In the 30s, people saved because the dollar actually appreciated constantly. It's beyond people's ability to recognize now, but treasury bills were so valued in the 1930s. The value of money was appreciating so much that treasury bills yielded 0.25%. That was the interest rate on them. They would have gone below zero if they could have, because you had to put your money somewhere. And of course, any time you owe money and the money is appreciating, you go right to the wall. I mean, it's a tough position to be in. And that's the position that we are in vis-a-vis the Japanese, because, as you know, the yen has been going up and up with our appetite for Japanese goods. So we will have to pay them back, earning more money even than the time at which we borrowed it.
If the American economy is basically being financed by Japanese money, if we're that in debt to Japan, what does that mean practically for us?
Well, it isn't being financed by Japan except at the margin. That is, we still do most of it ourselves. But when you don't have quite enough money, that last piece of money that comes in becomes very important to you, because you'd have to raise the interest rates to pull it in if you didn't have it. What it means to us over the long, it's going to be quite a while before the Japanese have a bigger gross national product than we do, but in 1970, we never thought they would be at this stage. So we're looking 10 or 15 years ahead. What would it mean? What it would mean is already happening, and that is that we pay more interest to them than we have been before. And second, that we lose a little bit of our leadership quality in the world. The Japanese are now the largest creditor. That is, more, they have loaned more money to more people than we have. And they are beginning to be one of the largest donor. You know, when you give aid to people, you get a lot of influence. So they have shied away from this role up to the last couple of years. And the Japanese face that you see when they are the largest lender asking for the money and telling people how to pay the money back, and the largest donor of aid and aid programs to the rest of the world, that'll be a different face than the one we've gotten used to over the last 20 years.
Does that mean that they could exert a certain political influence over us?
Well, they already do. They have a very powerful lobbying force in Washington. And the head of the Japanese Life Insurance Association, I don't want to be yellow peril or anything, but he gave a speech and he said, well, this is the way the Americans want to live, and it does mean that interest rates are set in Tokyo. And to some degree, of course, that's true. If they all stay home and sit on their hands, our interest rates have to go up in order to collect enough money to bubble on.
If we're borrowing all this money from Japan, and if the money is coming out of the savings of Japanese citizens, are we going to deplete their savings base?
Well, we don't deplete it. We just transfer it. You take the money from they have a U.S. government bond instead of a Japanese postal savings account. So they still have savings, but it's denominated in dollars and has to be paid back by us in dollars. Or as an investment, the Japanese have been buying, they bought 46% of the downtown real estate in Los Angeles and all of the beachfront in Waikiki and about a quarter of the office space in mid-Manhattan, which helps to balance the trade deficit. But you can only sell the country once, and you have to keep paying rent to the new people who own it. It's not, I think it's very healthy to get alarmed about this on the grounds that it tells you something is wrong and you should do something. I don't think it's unhealthy. I mean, it would be unhealthy if we just wrung our hands and ran around like Chicken Little.
My guest is Adam Smith, which is the pen name of George Goodman, who hosts the public TV show Adam Smith's Money World, is also the author of the bestsellers The Money Game and Paper Money, and has a new book called The Roaring Eighties. Now, we were talking about savings. There was a time when being in debt was something of an embarrassment. You would do anything possible to avoid being in debt. Do you think that that attitude has been changed with credit cards, since almost everybody has a credit card, almost everybody is in occasional debt to their credit card company?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sort of an abridged generation, but I don't think people have any fear at all of borrowing. They've been encouraged to. They've been rewarded for it on a consumer level and so on. And they have been right to do so. You know, everything you bought went up. I don't even think it's wrong right now.
To go into debt to buy something?
Yeah. I think it will be wrong when we change the policies of the country and people follow the policies. The best investment you could have ever made for the last generation is to buy a house because you had a triple subsidy.
Okay, so we're more in debt than we were.
We're more in debt than we were.
There's less money saved in the banks of America, so our government has to borrow money from abroad to pay back its national debt.
It doesn't even pay it back. It has to borrow money to pay the Navy and the post office.
Right. So, I mean, are we...
You can't open the post office Tuesday morning without Japanese life insurance companies.
Well, is our spending patterns as consumers and our saving patterns as Americans affecting the national debt and the ability of our government to pay it back?
Well, sure, because it borrows more. I don't fault the American people for this. They sort of mill around until they get a consensus, you know, and this sort of developed. And it's been the rampant consumer economy that has demanded that we spend. And we've responded to it. And we're doing what we're supposed to. So I don't fault people at all. But eventually, you have to get some leadership. The leadership has to say savings are a priority, just as it says education is a priority or competitiveness is a priority. And if it does, and when it does, then it will think of ways to reward saving and punish spending.
You write in your book that the 80s have been such an upside-down decade that debt has become a good thing among corporate speculators. And you write about leveraged buyouts. Leveraged buyouts are basically when individuals go borrow lots and lots of money to buy out a company. Now, why has this become such a profit-making enterprise in the 80s?
It's a mind-bogglingly profitable enterprise.
You want to give us the very basics of how this works?
Sure. You and I work for a company. I'm the president. You can be the chairman.
Thank you.
And we have we have 20,000 shareholders. And we're 50% debt and 50% equity. And an investment banker comes to it and says, I've run a blue book on your company. I've got all the stats here. I can line up the debt for you. Why don't you take this company private? Just you two own it instead of the 20,000 shareholders. Instead of being 50-50 debt and equity, you'll have 99% debt and 1% equity. So go borrow on your house. And now what we have is we have a 1% equity and 99% debt. And if we have a couple of good years at all, since only the two of us own the company instead of 20,000 people, we can make $500 million apiece or $100 million or whatever. That's a powerful incentive. Now, we could say, well, we are at risk. We could lose the money that we borrowed on our houses. And indeed, we could. But the rewards are so enormous. Why not do it? And, of course, the greatest example of this right now, it's peaking right now. When I wrote The Roaring Eighties, the biggest example of the LBO I had was Beatrice. Now we have one in RJR Nabisco that is suddenly the straw that broke the camel's back. It's the watershed. Because its executives wrote this plan that looked like they could make $200 million each and borrow an enormous amount of money. And the question you can always ask them is, well, they say, well, the stock market wasn't valuing our company high enough, so we had to do this. The question you can always ask them is, well, if you would do this for yourselves, why don't you do it for the shareholders? In other words, if you're going to break it up and spin off the tobacco company and sell the food companies, why don't you do it for everybody? And they'll say, well, we gave you a pop in the stock. What do you want?
So why did Nabisco become a turning point in the trend of leveraged buyouts?
Because the numbers are so big that the procedure finally sank in. William Simon, the ex-Treasury Secretary, was doing this 7 or 8 years ago. KKR, these people have made hundreds of millions of dollars. They started 10 years ago. And in the early days, you know, buy a nice $50 million company and let it work out. It's fine. This time, the numbers are so big that people started adding it up, and they started adding up these fees where the investment bankers are going to make $400 million and the lawyers are going to make $50 million. Do you know there was a legal bill sent the other day by Marty Lipton of a New York law firm who represented Kraft in the Philip Morris Kraft takeover, and they did 2 weeks' worth of work. Now, I do admit they worked very hard during those 2 weeks. They worked night and day. They worked weekends. But they sent a bill for the 2 weeks' work of $20 million. And they did perform a very good service. They got a higher price for Kraft. But that's the highest legal bill I've ever heard of. And the banking bills are even better. So this is the atmosphere in one corner of America. And this is what makes it the Roaring 80s. This is the kind of stuff that went on at the end of the 20s. A lot of leverage, the discovery of debt as a gift from the tooth fairy, a lot of people being able to make a lot of money very quickly. It's irresistible.
But do you regret, too, that so much of the people with a lot of money are spending their time buying and selling companies as opposed to generating new ideas?
I think you have to allow a certain amount of ferment in the capitalist system. It's the kind of yeast that makes it work. But something has to check it at some point. Now, we saw the first of the checks arrive the other day when the head of Metropolitan Life, John Creedon, decided to sue the RJR management on the grounds that his company was a bondholder. And the bondholders, of course, get punished when you add layers and layers of new bonds on top of the old ones. So the wind is turning, the tide is turning, but but the rewards are so great that people are going to keep right on going. Congress will take a look at it. It'll keep going. It's just too juicy to leave alone. It's very characteristic of the Roaring 80s, the time that we're living in.
My guest is Adam Smith, and that's the pen name of George Goodman. He hosts the public television series Adam Smith's Money World. He's also the author of the best-selling books The Money Game and Paper Money. He's a founder of New York Magazine, for which he's written. He's written for Esquire as well. His new book is called The Roaring 80s. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Now, before I reintroduce you again, let's get something straight. What do I call you? Do I call you Adam Smith or George Goodman?
Well, everybody calls me Adam Smith. Off the set, people call me Jerry Goodman, which is my nickname, but people always call me Adam Smith. That is the name that was put on a column I wrote in New York Magazine 22 years ago. It stuck. I've never been able to shake it. It started as a joke with quotation marks around it. It's very hard to lose.
Well, since your nickname is the name of the 18th century economist who was for laissez-faire economy, have people made incorrect assumptions about your economic views or correct assumptions?
Yeah, I don't think the people who did that, it became fashionable for certain people in the Reagan administration to wear Adam Smith ties. They used to send them to me. But they weren't really. The 18th century was a different century. The federal government spent during the Reagan years 24% of the GNP, just as it did before, almost $1 out of every four. I don't think it will ever go down greatly. And Adam Smith was a marvelous moral philosopher. Didn't know he was an economist. He was just a Scots tutor writing on things that interested him and teaching at the... But it simply was the first thing that came into the mind of whichever the editor was that put the pseudonym on. It was one of those things. It's like, I've often wondered about why other people, why Archie Leach ended up with the name Cary Grant, or David Cornwell, John le Carré, or Eric Blair, George Orwell. I can at least see a connection. What I was writing about was Wall Street, and this was the first dim connection that appeared to the people. And I've kind of gotten used to it.
Okay. You say in your book that in the 80s, people aren't ashamed to be wealthy.
Not at all.
Right? Now, you probably know a lot of wealthy people. I have no idea how much money you have yourself. But do you find this to be true in the circles that you travel in, that people behave differently around their own money than they used to?
Oh, I think so. First of all, there's much more of it. Because anytime you have a debt of $9 trillion, which we do now, government, public and private, that money is circulating, even though it has to be paid back. It has been, created. Somebody put it in the bank. Somebody drew it down. So I think houses get bigger and apartments get bigger. Vacations get longer. The cars get bigger and fatter. There's pressure on the most prestigious schools and so on. This is the crest of every boom.
Morton Zuckerman, who owns U.S. News and World Report and The Atlantic magazine and a lot of New York real estate, recently bought an apartment for $8.5 million. That's a lot of money.
It is, but you have only to remember the magazines I was talking about that are replacing Playboy and Penthouse, Architectural Digest and House and Garden and all these things. You can find ads in them for Seaside Homes in Santa Barbara for that kind of money. In Los Angeles and Beverly Hills and Rancho Santa Fe and San Diego.
Well, how can real estate possibly get that high? What does it say about our decade?
Well, it says that there's a lot of money being created, especially at the top of the spectrum, and it will gather around the things that money does constellate and collect on, and those things are fashionable apartments in fashionable cities. Art. You've seen the prices of art. There was a Picasso, I think, that just went yesterday for $38 million.
That's right. It set a new record for 20th century art.
Last week, there was a Jasper Johns for $17 million, the highest price ever for a living artist. If you go to, it's the Sotheby's and Christie's, the auction houses in New York, have now become like the Roman circus where the crowds gather hoping for blood, you know, and blood being the higher and higher prices, this thrill that runs through the auction room when a canvas goes from 10 to 15 to 20 to 30 to $40 million.
Will you paraphrase Tom Wolfe, who said that art certifies wealth? No one in his right mind pays these kind of prices for something he simply likes.
That's what Tom says. He's he's an old friend and a colleague of mine. We were in the early days of New York Magazine together, and his book does fictionally what the Roaring '80s does in nonfiction.
You have at least one book that's been a bestseller in Japan. Did you find yourself in the position of going to Japan and being a financial expert about how their economy runs?
Well, my first book became The Money Game, the first Adam Smith book, was actually my sixth book, became a bestseller in Japan, and they have all sold very well. But I didn't go as an expert on Japan. I went to, having worked on Wall Street, and when I would go to Japan and go on what talk shows I could go on, it was to talk about Wall Street and the American economy. That was where I first learned, though, that I first observed the Japanese with their ferocious work habits, planning to, the first time I went with the Money Game, they said they were going to overtake Britain, France, Italy, and the Soviet Union, and they did. And then they very shyly said, and perhaps someday, and then they didn't finish the sentence. And now they are talking about overtaking the United States. But I think Americans would find it very hard to realize the Japanese are now, they don't live as well as we do, but they are technically per capita richer. And yet, they still work Saturday. The Tokyo Stock Exchange is open on Saturday. The Tokyo Stock Exchange is trying to get its members not to work on Saturday, but they keep coming to work on Saturday. Japanese school children go to school 240 days a year Ours go 180. Naturally, by the time you get to high school, if you just add up the extra days, they're 2 years ahead.
Gee, wouldn't you hate it if our stock exchange was open on Saturdays? Another day you'd have
it
to,
used to be.
Follow it and worry?
It used to be. It used to be open half a day on Saturday. Now they don't. Now it's open half a day in Tokyo. And, of course, with global trading, if you want to sell something on Saturday, you can call your broker in Tokyo.
Do you think that one of the reasons why Japan has gotten ahead of the American economy is because the Japanese put so much money into industry and America sunk so much money into defense after the war?
I think that is one factor. But after all, that is, as the Japanese will continually tell you, the way we wanted it. We wrote an article into their constitution, Article 9, that said that they're supposed to be a peaceful Quaker country and they're only supposed to spend 1% of their GNP on defense. Now, of course, their economy has grown so much that 1% of that is quite a lot of money. They're the sixth largest military power now. That is one difference. Our very relaxed attitude about what we made and just the normal problems of being a fat cat and on top caught up with us. If you look at our trade deficit, a third of it was in cars, still is in cars. And we used to think in the late 60s that Japanese cars were a joke. They were junk. And Lee Iacocca, to his credit, said we better make the American small cars good because the Japanese are waiting in the wings. But Lee Iacocca himself didn't make small cars very well. And when the Americans got a chance to buy Japanese cars, which offered really quality first, quality and price, not to go to the repair shop all the time, that was the real breakthrough element in this trade deficit that we've built up. There are a lot of elements now in our trade deficit. We buy things from a lot of countries. We're an oil importer. But Japanese cars were the biggest single item. And it was a simple, I have an interview with Mr. Honda in the book, who founded Honda. And he said, well, if you make it right the first time, it's a better product. And it's so simple. It's so simple.
A question about personal finances. Do you handle your own, or do you have a broker who makes a lot of your investments for you?
Well, I've never been able to resist having somebody that I could call with an idea and trade it. But I have been, over my life, a director of a number of companies, and I sit on a couple of foundation boards. They always put me on the finance committee and so on. And doing that, I realized about diversity. So basically, I get a package of mutual funds together because I don't want to think about it. And I create a spectrum ranging from conservative. Each one does something different, value, income, stability, high growth. But I keep a little corner for myself just to have fun with.
So you handle it yourself, though? You make your own decisions?
Well, I handle the corner myself, sure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I read a lot of research the way some people read detective stories. When I go home and relax after the weekend, I want to see what the boys are coming up with, and all this stuff is piled up, people writing various kinds of research reports. I once ran a mutual fund, and so to me it's kind of recreation to see them either trying to fly old ideas or coming up with a genuine piece of good intellectual work or so on.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Adam Smith's new book, The Roaring Eighties, is published by Summit Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Peter Sikrofsky. For his latest book, Born Guilty, he spoke with the sons and daughters of former Nazis to learn how the issue of the Holocaust was dealt with in their families. I hope you can join us.
It's money that matters. You know what I say. It's money that matters. In the USA.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. British journalist Christopher Hitchens writes about the Washington power scene for publications like The Nation and The Spectator. He believes that the American press basically reinforces the political status quo. Coming up, Hitchens tells us why he's adapted a more confrontational style. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the late Ricky Nelson and tells the story of how Nelson went from being a TV star to a recording star and teen idol. And there's a new collection of travel essays by Alex Shumatov. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Senator George Mitchell of Maine was elected by his Democratic Senate colleagues today to the post of majority leader, defeating two more senior colleagues, Bennett Johnston of Louisiana and Daniel Inouye of Hawaii. Mitchell won 27 of the necessary 28 votes on the first ballot and was then elected unanimously in the second. A former federal judge, Mitchell gained national prominence for his tough but thoughtful questioning of former White House aide Oliver North. His job now is to guide legislation through the Senate and serve as a spokesman for the opponents of President-elect Bush. Bush met with Senate Republican leaders today, telling them he will seek speedy confirmation of his cabinet. Bush also told the Republican senators that he hopes any honeymoon period with Congress can yield a compromise on the federal budget. One senator present said Bush indicated a desire to meet with a bipartisan budget group to discuss his thoughts on the issue. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev delivered what was considered a conciliatory speech to the Supreme Soviet today in an effort to promote his reform package. The Soviet Parliament is considering far-reaching changes to the nation's constitution. Details from the BBC's Jeremy Harris.
It was a clear case of the carrot after the stick. The Soviet leader was in much less aggressive mood than over the weekend when he angrily condemned Estonian leaders for hasty and wrong-headed decisions. Mr. Gorbachev said fears that the authority of republics would be eroded by the reforms were misplaced, though he did acknowledge that some of the Kremlin's proposals had not been well defined. Amendments had now been introduced to about half of them. Mr. Gorbachev suggested an increase in the number of deputies from the republics and the setting up of a new body to define relations with central authority. He said calls for the extension of the rights of the republics were justified. Excessive centralism had stifled local initiatives. The response from the Baltic republics so far has been lukewarm. The Lithuanian president called for more radical change. We're tired, he said, of living under orders from above which limit our independence.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris in Moscow. Top management from the space shuttle program met today for their final review before Atlantis launch, which is set for Thursday morning. But NPR's Richard Harris says gloomy clouds still loom large and could postpone the secret mission.
Air Force weather forecasters are predicting gusty winds, clouds, and rain for the Florida coast Thursday morning. And bad weather could force NASA to delay Atlantis's launch. NASA has stricter weather requirements since the Challenger tragedy in 1986. Clouds must be minimal, no rains allowed, and winds must be light, particularly at ground level, in case Atlantis has to make an emergency landing at the Kennedy Space Center's landing strip. But top managers at Cape Canaveral said today that preparations are proceeding well for the launch, and they're ready as soon as the weather permits. Atlantis is flying a secret military mission, but informed sources say it's carrying a satellite that will spy on Soviet military operations. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Federal Aviation Administration told the nation's commercial airlines today that it wants them to install a backup warning device in jetliner cockpits to tell pilots whether the takeoff alarm system is working. Those alarm systems are supposed to warn pilots if the plane's critical control devices, such as wing flaps, are not in proper position for takeoff. However, in at least two recent crashes, it is suspected that the alarms failed to sound because of a malfunction. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has ordered operators of all commercial nuclear power plants to check their safety systems for counterfeit and possibly faulty circuit breakers. An NRC spokesman says the order, issued November 22nd, noted that recent inspections indicate a potential safety concern. Stock prices rose sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow jumped more than 20 points, closing at 2101.53. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. MTV may be a relatively new phenomenon in the grand scheme of rock and roll, but the idea of making a career in rock with a lot of help from television isn't. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of TV's first rock idol, Ricky Nelson.
Well, I've tried everything to get along with you. Now I'm gonna tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna quit my crying. I'm gonna leave you alone. If you don't believe I'm leaving, you can count the days I'm gone. I'm gonna leave. You're gonna need your loving daddy someday.
Eric Hilliard Nelson, to give his full name, was born in 1940, son of a famous bandleader and his wife. By the time he was 12, Ricky was playing himself on his parents' pioneering sitcom, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. If he'd ever had ideas about doing something else, too bad. Ricky got to grow up in public on TV. This meant that he also got to share his enthusiasms with the audience, which is how he became a rock and roll star. One night, he was on a date with a girl who found Elvis singing over the radio, a lot more interesting than Ricky sitting beside her. In a last-ditch attempt to impress her, he told her he was making a record that week and then wound up having to make good on it. Ozzy pulled some strings, and soon Ricky was in the studio cutting a cover version of Fats Domino's hit, I'm Walking.
I'm walking, yes indeed, I'm talking about you and me, and I'm hoping that you come back to me. Oh yeah, I'm lonely as I can be, and I'm waiting for your company, and I'm hoping that you come back to me.
The record took off, and Verve, the label it was on, was dismayed to find that they'd only cut a one-record deal with Ozzy, and that Ricky had just signed a major deal with Imperial, Fats Domino's label. What Verve hadn't counted on was that Ozzy had had Ricky close the program singing his hit, something any bandleader from the 30s would have done.
A bebop, baby, a bebop, baby, a bebop, baby, she's a gal for me. She got plenty of rhythm, got plenty of jive, and when we dance, I really come alive. My love for her so tender and sweet, my heart starts pounding every time we meet. A bebop baby, still in her teens, is as sweet as she can be. Bebop baby in her old blue jeans is a bebop baby for me. A bebop baby for me.
So when Bebop Baby, his first Imperial record, came out, the musical slot at the end of the show was already established, and it was how Ricky, who after all had commitments to the show and couldn't tour, let his fans know what was going on. Ricky's typical teenager looks and adenoidal pop voice made him a sort of safe Elvis, and his songs tended to revolve around real teenage themes.
Well, I've been waiting ever since I guess my baby's got another date. Stood up, brokenhearted again. I'll bet she's out having a ball, not even thinking of me at all. Stood up, brokenhearted again.
Ricky's songs were just vulnerable and just macho enough to make adults happy, but teenagers could identify with them wholeheartedly.
I believe for what you say when you say you're going steady with nobody else but me. I believe for what you say when you say you don't kiss nobody else but me. I believe you're going steady with nobody else but me.
And there was something else. Ricky had the best songwriters and band money could buy. Believe What You Say was written by Johnny and Dorsey Burnett, Tennessee rockabillies who'd come to L.A. to make it big. And that guitar lick was played by the legendary James Burton, who was the centerpiece of Ricky's band. Check him out on the B-side of Stood Up, a number called Waiting in School.
I've been waiting in school all day long, waiting on the bell to ring so I can go home. I throw my books on the table, pick up the telephone. Hello, baby, let's get some going. Heading down to the drugstore to get a soda pop, throw a nickel in the jukebox, then we start to rock. My school gal, baby, gonna taste some news. You should look good in the baby doll shoe. Well, it's a one, two, a foot of a shoe. A three, four, get out on the floor. 5, 6, come get your kicks down the corner of Lincoln and a 46. Yeah!
It was, of course, very hip to consider Ricky Nelson uncool, especially as the 50s ended and his material got closer to mainstream pop. He dropped the Y from the end of his name when he turned 20 and soon fell into obscurity. In 1969, he came back with a superb country rock band, the Stone Canyon Band, and had a hit with a Dylan song, She Belongs to Me. And a couple of years later, after a very unpleasant experience with an oldies show at Madison Square Garden in New York, he recorded his last hit, Garden Party. In it, he savagely attacked the audience that wouldn't let him change, that wouldn't let him do things his way.
Played them all the old songs, I thought that's why they came. No one heard the music, we didn't look the same. I said hello to Mary Lou, she belongs to me. When I sang a song about a honky-tonk, it was time to leave. But it's all right now, I learned my lesson well. See, you can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself.
He kept on, though, right to the end. On New Year's Eve, as 1985 turned into 1986, a faulty heater on his band's creaky old airplane malfunctioned, and he and his band went down in the East Texas woods. At least he'd lived to see people go back to his old records and respect them for what they were. Good, solid, professional pop records with just enough rock and roll.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
If I'm all alone, some people call me a teenager. Some people say they envy me. I guess they got no way.
This is Fresh Air. Christopher Hitchens is a British journalist writing about American politics for such magazines as The Nation, The Spectator, and Harper's. His own political views are left of center, something he never hides from his editors or his readers. In fact, he criticizes the American press for having elevated objectivity to an ideology. Hitchens moved to the United States in 1980 when Victor Navasky, editor of The Nation, invited him to write a column. His essays and columns from the past 8 years have been collected in a new book titled Prepared for the Worst. Hitchens writes that if this collection has a point, it is the desire of one individual to see the idea of confrontation kept alive. I asked Christopher Hitchens if he thought of himself as a confrontational journalist.
Yes, I do. Very much so. I think it's essential to bring ridicule to bear, to bring irony to bear, to bring satire to bear on the... Especially this has been true in the last 8 years, which the collection Prepare for the Worst implies by its name an attitude to. Time of tremendous lying and tremendous euphemism and tremendous dishonesty, and nobody really prepared to call things by their right names.
Well, you criticize the press for treating Reagan as a blooper merchant instead of as a habitual liar.
Well, that's right. No one would say that what he was doing was lying. It all had to be, oh, he misspoke, or he misstated himself, or the president appeared confused, when he was really trying to lie his way out of a tight corner. And whereas, you see, this also reflects on another thing I'm very much against, which is the standard of pseudo-objectivity taken by most of the press, whereby you mustn't be, another word I hate, judgmental. You mustn't editorialize. Now, see how this comes out. The phrase Ronald Reagan is a great communicator has appeared in every paper you've ever read as a fact, as a piece of news. They say, they go on about what a great communicator he is. Matter of fact, that is a value judgment. It's a matter of opinion. It is editorializing. It's judgmental. It's not a fact at all. Can't be weighed as a fact. This phrase Ronald Reagan is a liar has never appeared in any newspaper you read, though it is a factually verifiable statement. It would be nonetheless considered to be judgmental. If you see what I mean by that example, you'll see what I mean by the need for confrontation.
Well, the mainstream press prides itself on being objective. Do you think that there's a political view that's actually expressed by journalistic outlets that think of themselves as being objective?
I think objectivity is an ideology in itself. You cannot be objective unless you are literally mindless. If you have a mind, it will evolve a position. And the best thing to do is to state honestly what that is and submit it to the test of evidence and experience. But people here, I think, confuse objectivity with detachment, with impartiality, and with other apparently desirable things that are not really theoretically attainable. What they end up with is mere neutrality, mere indifference, which always, as it turns out, has a bias towards the status quo and the powers that be.
You have a piece that's very funny that you call Blabscam in your new collection, and it's about being on the Sunday morning talk shows and the shows of sparring political journalists arguing with each other and taking different positions on the issues of the day.
Or not doing so.
Or not doing so, right. You say you were held back a little bit.
Well, yes, actually, that is one area where I think anyone with real opinions does suffer. I think the allegedly confrontational free-for-all TV shows that come out of Washington are utterly fraudulent. They're all designed to reinforce the existing consensus of opinion, which is predominantly a conservative one. And that this is done under the pretense, which is what annoys me, of being unscripted, two-fisted, into the ring and let's have it out. Particularly this is true of the McLaughlin Group, that sort of zoo program that quite a lot of people are now addicted to. Where, in fact, the whole thing is fixed completely in advance. Everyone knows what the question is going to be, in what order it's going to be asked of them.
You were briefed beforehand?
Absolutely, many times. I mean, it was a week of briefing before one went on the air. And the whole thing is designed, actually, to make sure that it comes out as another bit of consensus, strained through pseudo-objectivity.
You know, when I got your book, I skimmed the book jacket before actually reading the book. And on the book jacket, it said that there's an essay about how you discovered your Jewishness, and I thought that meant that you had gotten more in touch with your Jewish roots. Well, when I read the piece, I found out you actually discovered for the first time that your mother was Jewish, that her side of the family was Jewish. Can you tell us the story of how you found that out?
Yes, I can. I can sketch it for you. I mean, it was the family secret. My mother's family had emigrated from Central Europe at the end of the last century. And though they had, until my grandmother's time, remained religious and kept up the Jewish observances, they had changed their names. They'd anglicized their names. And in my mother's generation, I never talked about it with her because she died before I discovered this. A decision must really have been taken to assimilate. I mean, she married a British naval officer, my father, towards the end of the war. And I think, my speculation is, her ambition was for me to grow up as an English gentleman and not to know that there was this family secret. And she also kept it from my father, who I'm certain wouldn't have minded, but whose possibly elements of whose family might have been a little wary of having a Jewish woman marry in. But at any rate, it was the family secret, and I discovered it because my grandmother, my Jewish grandmother, outlived both my father and my mother.
Do you think of it as cowardly at all that your family covered up their Jewishness?
Not cowardly exactly, no. I mean, Britain has never been a country that persecutes the Jews, but it is a country where there's a lot of quiet, furtive prejudice and a certain amount of discrimination. And I think they thought, you know, without completely betraying our roots, you know, we can assimilate and get by this. And I think what makes people do that is their children. They don't want them to have to be discriminated against. And so what that means in this case is that I was the one who was supposed to be, you know, preserved from any discrimination. Well, the fact is, I would consider anyone who disliked Jews to be a personal enemy at any rate, and would hope to arouse their hostility or dislike. So I don't mind getting whatever's coming from that quarter.
You have been very critical toward Israel, and one of your editors said something very funny to you. She said, well, so you're Jewish, well, this will be good for you because it's okay for Jews to criticize Israel. And that's actually a very funny thing to say, but I was wondering if you thought that you would end up somehow reconsidering any of your politics, or if you had to think about whether finding out that you were Jewish was cause for thinking about rethinking politics.
Well, I was actually rather annoyed when that editor said it to me, because it seemed, though I could see what she meant, it was in a way a slightly heartless remark. It isn't as if I can now say, well, okay, I'm allowed to criticize Israel, because that's sectarian. It'd be tribal to think like that. The Middle East is a very urgent subject of concern for anyone who thinks about or cares about politics. It has huge international implications. It involves everybody. It's going nuclear. It already involves huge questions of strategy. So I think anyone has a right to take an interest in it. And I think anyone who looks at it objectively, or tries to look at it objectively, will see that a huge injustice has been done to the Palestinians. And they'll see that whether they're Jewish or not. And many, many Jews, Israelis and diaspora Jews, have always recognized that. At the moment, unfortunately, that view is not the predominant one.
Now, I think your revelation about, you know, Jewishness in your family brings up a really interesting question, and that is, how much does or how much should family history influence your own choices in life? And I mean, how much does it affect the way you decide to live your life, and how much does new information affect the course of your life?
Well, I mean, we are the things that our families make us, but I think education and culture can get us to the point where we realize, look, there is only one race, which is the human race. The fact that most people, let's face it, believe in Islam because they're born in Islamic countries. The same is true of most Catholics. They're Catholics, they're born into Catholic families. We've, in this century, reached a point where we can transcend that. We know there are alternatives, and we know that there are visions beyond the merely national or tribal or religious. I think we will never be able to overcome our family roots. And one doesn't want to be contemptuous of one's parents, but one ought to try, I think, and outgrow them. And by that, I mean intellectually as well. It's the best answer I can come up with, I think.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Christopher Hitchens' collection of essays, Prepared for the Worst, is published by Hill and Wang. This is Fresh Air. Let's get a rundown on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Alex Chadwick. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
President Gorbachev in the Soviet Union spoke to the Supreme Soviet there, which is their parliament, and proposed a major constitutional changes there, which could change the way government functions in the Soviet Union, increase the sense of democracy there, in the sense that there's any sense of it at all. There are coming changes, and we'll have a report. We also have an interview tonight with Secretary of State Schultz, in which he says he intends to maintain his ban on a visit here by Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and also a conversation with Maurice Sendak, the famous illustrator of children's books.
Thanks, Alex. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The days of the gentleman travel writer and the romance, innocence, and imperial observations that went along with the style are for the most part over. Book critic John Leonard says African Madness, a new collection of travel essays by Alex Shumatov, is the new reality.
Alex Shumatov, a staff writer for The New Yorker who writes as well, which is to say wonderfully, for Vanity Fair and other magazines, is reported to live in Mexico City. I can't imagine he spends much time there. He seems always off to the Amazon, or the Antarctic, or the Mongol steppes, with his two sons in tow as often as he can manage, because, he says, I don't like to be away from them, and they make my work easier. They break the ice for me. His work, of course, is travel writing, or to be more precise, travel understanding. Shumatov may want his third world tropics to be everything the first world isn't. He may look abroad for, quote, ecstatic light and color and overpowering beauty, the seething, radiant life of the rainforests, the generosity and the gentleness of the people. And sure enough, in, say, Madagascar, the island that detached itself from the African mother continent 160 million years ago, he'll find enough exotica to bemuse and delight. The bottle-trunked, crassulescent baobab tree, the bygone elephant bird, the dog-faced, monkey-bodied, panda-coated Indri lemur, or even a Mikia pygmy whose feet are pointed backwards so he can't be tracked by as many enemies. But Madagascar is a dying island, and the mother continent is scourged by famine, bloodshed, and AIDS. The nightmares of history got there before Shumatov. In Central Africa alone, there are 11 cities with populations of more than a million, and Shumatov has seen alienated young men from the bush go mad and run naked on the downtown streets at night, screaming. In Rwanda, the Diane Fossey, made famous by Sigourney Weaver in the recent movie, may have loved her gorillas, but Shumatov finds that she also tortured the native poachers whom she called Wagipoos because their antelope snares occasionally injured her pets. In the Central African Republic, in what the imperialists used to call French Equatorial Africa, Shumatov sits in on the trial of the Emperor Bokassa for high crimes and misdemeanors, and there is nothing radiant, generous, or gentle about it. Bokassa was in the habit of eating people he didn't like. When the French finally bounced him, if we can believe the French, they found human flesh in the palace freezer, trussed up with string like rib roasts. In Uganda and Zaire, there's an AIDS epidemic, and at least 4 million Africans are going to die, and nobody really knows why, any more than anybody knows why so many will die in New York and San Francisco. I imagine myself, says Shumatov, as a latter-day Ponce de Leon, searching for the fountain of death, or as Captain John Speke, about to discover Lake Victoria, the source of the White Nile. How curious it would be, I think, if the source of the Nile and the source of AIDS proved to be one and the same. His despairing essays break the heart. And this is what is happening to all our best travel writers. They can no longer leave home wholehearted, and wherever they go, there is no innocence to be found, in the cities or in history. They collect madness instead of souvenirs.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed African Madness by Alex Shumatov. Here's a look at the next fresh air. In his novels and New Yorker cartoons, William Hamilton pokes fun at the rich. As for Hamilton, he's mastered the art of looking wealthy without having any money. On tomorrow's Fresh Air, I speak with William Hamilton about well-cut suits with empty pockets. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews several new compact discs featuring cellist Pablo Casals in performances of Bach and Beethoven. These are the first of Casals' many recordings to be transferred to CD. And urban legends expert Jan-Harald Brunvann discusses chain letters. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.